This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. I'm Sean Tubbs. The second debate for the two candidates in the 57th House District was held on Thursday, October 20th at Burnley Middle School in Charlottesville. The 57th District has been represented by Democrat Mitch Van Yeres for several years. The two men vying to replace him are Democrat David Toscano and Republican Tom McChrystal. This debate is moderated by Karen Waters of the Quality Community Council and lasts for about 70 minutes.
Before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge the sponsors of our event tonight, the Quality Community Council, the Interfaith Gay-Straight Alliance, the League of Women Voters, and the Virginia Organizing Project. We would also like to thank the staff of the Burley Middle School for their cooperation in using the cafeteria tonight. I'd like to introduce our two candidates. Running as a Republican for the House of Delegates from the 57th District is Tom McChrystal. Running as a Democrat for the House of Delegates from the 57th District is David Toscano. The format tonight will be simple. We will collect written questions from the audience, and as moderator, I'll ask the panelists one question at a time, taking turns who goes first. There will be a two-minute time limit for each answer. We hope you'll keep your questions focused to state policy and that they're answerable in 2 minutes. Anytime that you would like to have Joe bring you over a card, just raise your hand. We've already collected a number of questions, and Mr. Joe Zakos will be our timekeeper tonight. We flipped a coin, which determined that Mr. McChrystal will go first. Mr. McChrystal's opening statement will be 3 minutes, as will Mr. Toscano's. Mr. McChrystal.
Hi, thank you. First, before we begin, I'd like to thank all of the sponsors, and I'd really like to thank you all for coming out tonight. This is an important election, and I'm really glad to see that there are, you know, thoughtful people who really want to think about who the best person is to represent the 57th. I also want to start out by thanking David for, we've had, I think, a gentlemanly campaign, as Bob Gibson pointed out, and while I think we agree on many things, we disagree on other things, and it's, for me, this has been a good experience as a campaign. So anyway, if you don't know me, I'm Tom McChrystal. I'm the chief technology officer at a multimedia company downtown called Creative Perspectives. We've had our business downtown for 15 years. You may also know me as a lacrosse coach, or you may know me as the founding chairman of the Virginia Piedmont Technology Council, which after 7 years now gives voice to about 200 technology companies from the Charlottesville and surrounding region. David and I both attended another forum today, and one of the things that I noticed is that incumbent people talk about the committees that they're on. So I'm not an incumbent yet, but I'd like to tell you about the committees that I've been on in Richmond legislatively. The Virginia legislature created a body called the Joint Commission on Technology and Science. They deal with hard issues of technology and law. And as part of that, they've created advisory committees, citizen advisory committees, where they ask people who hopefully have something to contribute to look at legislation, act on it, and then move their recommendations up. For 2 years, I've been appointed to the Advisory Committee on Privacy. I'm proud to say that because of my work, a couple of bills to protect your privacy have been passed, and I actually have language that I wrote that's part of the Code of Virginia. I know how hard it is to actually write good law, and I think I've been successful at it. The last year, and actually currently, I'm serving on the Advisory Committee on Integrated Government, which is looking at ways to make government work better, make it cost less by using technology. And an awful lot of that has been listening to what's going on. And I've gotten a greater appreciation for the legislative oversight function. There are a lot of issues that are coming up, for instance, UVA's management restructuring agreement, that the legislature really needs to keep an eye on. And I've been in Richmond. I've been part of that process. I think the third thing that I want you to know about me is I listen. First, people have preconceived notions about who people are based on the party that they're part of. And I think David and I have both been a little bit different than our parties. The first thing that I did is I went out and I talked to a lot of people who you would not consider to be typical Republican constituencies. I sat down with Jan Cornell at the UVA staff union because I wanted to get their side of what was going on at UVA. I've talked with many, many different constituency groups, and I have to tell you, listening is a really important part of this job. I've had my eyes open to things that need to get fixed, things that don't need to be fixed, and you can count on me over the course of the next 2 years, should I go to Richmond, that I will continue to listen, I will continue to represent you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McChrystal. Mr. Toscano?
You want to bring this over on top of you or on behind?
You can't hear? How about now? Good evening, everybody, and thank you all for coming out. Thank you for sponsoring this discussion. It is true, as Tom said, we've had some very nice talks about things, and we differ on some things, and we agree on some things. I want to spend a few minutes telling you a little bit about myself and the kinds of things I believe in, and then we can get right to the questions. I was born in Syracuse, New York, the first of five children. I went on to school in upstate New York and went on to graduate school in Boston. I worked myself through school as the first in my family to go on to higher education and get a degree. And I worked myself through school by working in my dad's clothing store, by working at a print shop, and I even drove a cab in Boston, Massachusetts. And I'll tell you about that sometime. That's a real trip. I've been in Virginia since 1981. I've been married to the same woman for 27 years, and I've got a 7.5-year-old son who's in public school at Brennan Moran, second grade. I've been on the city council for 12 years and mayor in the mid-90s. And I've really, really always embraced the notion of public service. I continue to embrace that notion because I feel very strongly that people need to have more control over the economic, political, and personal decisions that affect their lives. And so that's why in my time in public service, I've always reached out and brought people in, engaged them in the discussion, involved them in the room. Cardinal rule of politics is that decisions are made by people in the room at the time. And I've always thought it's important to have a lot of people in the room, regardless of people's economic status or their position in the community. I think like a lot of you in this room, that we need to spread economic opportunity and hope to the broadest cross-section of the public. And that's why I really focused very hard on funding education first, at all levels, from preschool to elementary to high school, through the community college systems, through higher education, and universities in this great Commonwealth. And I'm going to continue to support those things when I go to Richmond. And I believe, like many of you in this room, that we have a responsibility to leave this planet a better place than when we found it. And that's why I support things like investing in cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay, making sure that our streams are swimmable and fishable, attacking the problem of mercury pollution in our air and in our water. And I'm going to work very hard on those things if I get elected to represent you in the House of Delegates. 2 years ago, this Commonwealth faced a serious crisis of leadership. We were faced with a dilemma whether we're going to continue to fund critical social services, public safety, education. And a lot of people stood with Governor Mark Warner and progressive Republicans, moderate Republicans in the House and the Senate and said, yes, we are going to step up to the plate. We are going to pass a budget that works. And now we're seeing the benefits of that. We're going to have to continue to work on those budgetary issues, and I hope to be involved in Richmond to help represent you in those critical decisions that we face in the years ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, our first question of this evening. Will you be attentive to the needs of the mentally ill, mentally retarded, and substance addicted, some of our most vulnerable citizens? For no cuts in Medicaid, funds for a Medicaid match, if the federal government cuts, funds for greater community services.
Well, I'm not sure that that question can actually be answered in 2 minutes. But I have a nephew who's autistic, and I know how important it is to have a support net, a safety net. I also know how important when people sometimes have mental illness, we really need to work at getting them back into the mainstream, helping them. One of the roles of government, in my opinion, is we need to have government for people who can't help themselves, and those are some of the most vulnerable members of our society. On the funding, I've been looking at Medicaid quite a bit. Medicaid is a large portion of our state budget. We have no control over it, and it's getting larger and larger. We have to be a lot more innovative about how we deal with helping people get well. You know, Medicaid, it seems, has become a program about nursing homes. It seems to be a program about ambulance operators. Medicaid has one primary purpose that we need to get back to, and that is providing health care for people who can't pay for it. The Republican caucus has actually really been very aggressive about looking at some Medicaid things in terms of reforming it, in terms of looking at how we can get fraud out of it, in terms of looking at how we can deliver more services for less money. It's a critically important issue. You can't talk about it in 2 minutes. It really deserves a forum all its own. But I see it as one of the most critical issues that we need to be looking at.
We're going to tie you up before it's all over, Karen. Great question. Really difficult to answer in two minutes. But the short answer is yes. And part of that answer is based on my record. You know, I have a record. You're going to hear me say that a lot tonight. I do have a record, and it's a record of supporting those kinds of initiatives locally in 12 years on the city council. If you look at the city budget for Region 10 Community Services, which is the primary agency on the firing line to try to provide these services, we made sure when I was on the council that we had as much money in that budget as we possibly could, even when the state was cutting it back. Take another example, drug court. When drug court was in danger of being cut, I went to people in this community and I said, we need to raise some private money. And we raised some private money. And drug court is one of the best ways of helping divert people who have substance abuse problems out of the criminal justice system to be able to be restored to productive lives in this community. There are a number of other things that we've done during the time as I was on council. The Medicaid problem is a huge problem. It's about 12% of the general fund budget of the state. It's not going away, and the feds are only going to make it worse. I don't think we should be engaged in thinking about cutting Medicaid. We need to think about ways in which we can expand it to help people who are most in need. And I'm hoping I'm going to be able to do that when I get to Richmond.
What do you think of Meredith Richards' idea to get more rail service to Charlottesville, and will you help her to make it happen?
Thanks. I guess we're going to do the hopping up and down here.
Yeah. It's fine if he answers every question first. I'm not sure it's fair. But
oh, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Do you want to
yeah, I'm really happy to answer this question. I've had many long talks with Meredith about this particular initiative, and in fact, I've been working in the General Assembly talking to members about the importance of making this happen. It's rail service is really, really important in terms of bringing tourists in, and it's also really important in terms of allowing people who work in Charlottesville or who live in Charlottesville to be able to work in other places. As a business person, I do a lot of business up in D.C., and I prefer to take the train. It's a great way to go up. There are some things about Meredith's program that I think can be improved a little bit. Right now, she's talking about having Virginia Rail Express run it with their existing equipment. I've gone out and I've actually found some equipment that's now just out on the market that we can lower the operating costs in a quarter. That will make the finances of it work an awful lot better. So it's not a question of will I help. I'm already on that. I'm already in the game. I've already talked to people. The caucus knows all about it, and I'm committed to making better rail service a reality.
Part of the solution to our transportation problem is going to have to involve rail. And it was heartening to see the General Assembly ponied up some real money last year, not a lot, I think it was $23 million, to help improve rail service. Now, the idea of extending rail service to Charlottesville is not a new idea. There are a number of people who have been talking about it for a long period of time. It is going to take money because it's very expensive to invest in the infrastructure necessary to make that a reality. Right now, the Amtrak trains travel on privately owned right-of-way. And that's part of one part of the problem of why they don't always run on time, because the priorities go to the freight lines. And we really, in a sense, need dedicated rail lines, dedicated rights-of-way, and that's going to be very expensive. Beyond rail, passenger rail, I think we need to think about rail in for freight, particularly up and down the Shenandoah Valley. I mean, we've got a huge problem on the horizon with the potential expansion of I-81, or the non-expansion of I-81, leaving it to be controlled by huge trucks that put a lot of people in danger. And part of that solution, I think, is going to be a rail solution. And I'm hoping that that I'm going to be able to work on that with other members of the General Assembly to get it done.
Great. Stay there, because we're going to start with you this time. What do you think is a living wage for a person working full-time in Charlottesville? In other words, how much does a full-time worker need to enjoy a decent quality of life in this area?
That's a very good question, and that's more than a two-minute answer, too, because when you think about what a person needs, it's so dependent on their circumstance. If you're a family, if you're living singly, it's one thing. If you're a family of four, it's quite another. The wage that's been talked around here is about $9.43, I think it is. Was that a living wage? I'm not convinced. If you add that up, it's very close to a poverty wage anyway. The question in my mind is, how do you move the society forward to improve wages across the board? In this area, we're very fortunate because there are, I mean, compared to other areas, the wage rates, the market wage rates are a lot higher. The housing rates, though, are a lot higher, too, so people get squeezed. Did you know that there are some 10,000 wage employees of the state of Virginia who are not even paid $7.25 an hour? Now, think about this when we're talking about living wage and people not being paid $7.25 an hour. My view is that the minimum wage in the United States needs to be raised by the Congress. They're not going to do it. So I think we should give them a year and then say, we as a state are going to do it, and we're going to do it in phases. We're going to start by paying public employees at least the minimum wage, and then we're going to raise it for the rest of the Commonwealth and join 17 other states in the District of Columbia in saying we think people ought to be paid more than the feds are authorizing them to be paid.
This is one place where I think David and I are going to differ. I think my experience, just in terms of a number, is if you're making less than $24,000 a year in Charlottesville, it's really tough. Charlottesville is an extraordinarily expensive place to live. I was actually looking a couple of months ago on the Realtors Multiple Listing Service, and there was not a single house in Charlottesville on the market for $220,000. Nothing less than that. That's not affordable housing. People can't afford to live here in Charlottesville. And frankly, one of the reasons that Charlottesville is unaffordable is because some of the decisions that have been made by the Charlottesville City Council over the last few years. You know, we have not gotten the density that we need. So what it's doing is it's pushing people to move to Greene County. It's pushing people to move to Nelson County, to Fluvanna County. It's just not affordable to live in Charlottesville. And part of it is the zoning and planning decisions that were made by the Charlottesville City Council. That's part of it. In terms of the minimum wage, you know, there's a catch-22. If you raise the wages, the minimum wage, you decrease the number of jobs that you can create. New jobs and starter jobs tend to be the jobs that are down at the bottom. And if you raise the rate, if you're a small business person who, frankly, are the people who generally create most of the jobs, you can't, if the wages, the minimum wage goes up, Maybe rather than hiring three new people and creating three new jobs, you create two. So I look at this like a businessman, and I realize that if what we're trying to do is give people better jobs, then we need to create more of them. It's as simple as that. You know, I think that, you know, there are things that we need to do in terms of creating better technology jobs in this area and across the state. And if we have more high-paying jobs, then we don't, the issue of the minimum wage goes away. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. McChrystal. We're going to start with you next. Okay. This is for both of you. The Seville Weekly wrote that the only difference between the two of you is that one has a mustache. How are you different from your opponent, and why do you think that means you'll do a better job in Richmond?
Well, I'm the guy with the mustache. I think David and I have some very different sets of experiences. And I think David's experience, the fundamental difference is that David's experience is here in Charlottesville. He's been on city council. You know, he's worked on local problems. I can tell you, as someone who has spent a considerable amount of time in Richmond working on state problems, working on technology problems, working on problems that affect everyone, the process is different there. Things get done differently. In Charlottesville, you have essentially five people in a room who make all of the decisions. In Richmond, you have 100 people in the House and, you know, and people in the Senate. Getting things done in Richmond is a very, very different process. It takes quite a while to actually learn to the lay of the land, learn how people interact, learn the process of how things work. It takes a while. And I think the biggest difference between David and I is that David's got great experience running a city. I've got the experience that's really important, and that experience is working at the state level, making laws, and getting stuff done legislatively. I think that's the biggest difference.
Mr. Scott?
Well, I do think the experience issue does come in. I mean, I have a long experience of being involved in local issues, and I like to think I really know this community pretty well. I'm always learning more. You know, one of the things that I've been around long enough to know that I don't know everything. But I've also been around long enough that I know a lot of people who can tell me most everything. And as long as I've got that and I can key into that, I can do a good job for you in Richmond. You know, if you look at some of the issues, part of the problem is, you know, I don't always know where Tom stands. You know where I stand because all you have to do is go to my website, and I got a zillion issues on that website. I go to Tom's website, you know, and I can read his blog, but it doesn't tell me a lot. So I'm not sure, other than our exchanges in these debates, where he stands on a wide range of issues. In reality, I think he does agree with a lot of things, I believe. But I'd like to think you ought to vote for the real thing. And I trust that when you consider the experience and you compare what you perceive to be the differences in our positions, you'll conclude that maybe I'm the person that you'd like to support.
Thanks. David, I'm going to start with you again now. What is your position on regulatory barriers that restrict small family farmers' ability to sell and consumers' rights to buy food direct from farmers?
I think they ought to be loosened up. I think that some of these regulations are manufactured by the bureaucrats in Richmond, and I think it's worth examining whether they ought to remain on the books. You know, consumers, as long as their health and safety are being protected, ought to have the right to purchase things in the marketplace. And, I mean, that's the key point, though. I mean, it's health. And and some of the things you try to assess is whether the regulations are reasonable to protect the health and safety of the public.
Thanks. Mr. McChrystal?
Actually, I've had an email exchange today, and one of the things that I actually committed to the group of local farmers who sell at the city market is that I will sponsor legislation once I get to Richmond to fix some of the problems. Right now, Virginia Department of Health has been on a crusade against one guy who makes goat cheese. You know, it's wrong. It infuriates me. And the great thing about the relation about the city market and farmers markets in general is that it's commerce at its most fundamental. It's about relationships. When you go to the city market, you get to talk to people about how they grew your lettuce. You get to talk to people about how they made the goat cheese or the recipe that they used for the biscuits that you buy. It's a relationship. And it's important because I get to make buying decisions based on the relationship and the information that I have. We don't need somebody interceding saying, you know, this goat cheese wasn't made the right way. It's one case where regulation is really gets in the way of consumers from doing what they want to do. I'm the son, the grandson, and the great-grandson of dairy farmers. I remember what it was like before, when I was a little kid, what it was like on a dairy farm. And to me, the relationship between farmers and people who eat the food is really kind of sacred. So you can be sure that, you know, David doesn't know what issues I'm going to talk about. Well, I will tell you that one of the bills that I will introduce is going to fix the problem and fix it forever.
Thank you. There has been a trend toward privatizing many state services. Computer services and transportation are two recent ones. What do you believe is the recent role of state government in providing services, and how appropriate is privatization?
It really depends on the service. I've actually been very engaged in, and as part of the Integrated Government Committee, we're looking at one of the great experiments in privatization. The Virginia Information Technology Agency is putting together these private procurement situations where they can actually go out, buy computer services, buy various services. The contracts are actually being negotiated sort of in private right now. And there's great concern as to what those are going to actually look at. It's important to me that we provide the best services that we can for the lowest cost that's possible. And sometimes privatizing it is really, really the way to go, particularly where there's a model in the private sector where there's outsourcing of services. Companies buy from IBM, from HP. They do those kind of things because it's the best way of getting the services. And we need to look at how we can do this. Sometimes it's appropriate, sometimes it's not appropriate. Really making it work it's all about legislative oversight and making sure that the people who are in the legislature are minding the stores. I think it works. I also don't think that if we try it and it doesn't work, I don't think that we should be ashamed about saying, hey, that one didn't work, let's pull it back in-house. Companies do that as well. So it's something that I think should be an important component, but you know, it really depends on the deal. And I think anyone who says it doesn't depend on the deal hasn't really looked at the situation very carefully.
One of the things I like about Tom is I really don't think that he's an ideologue. If you were to ask this question to a huge number of the Republicans in the Republican caucus, they would start talking about the effectiveness of the market and the importance of letting the private sector do it in ways better than the government could ever do it. So I like the way he put it. He said it depends. And in point of fact, it does. I mean, you got to ask yourself several questions. One, will it cost less to privatize, short-term and long-term? Two, will the service be as good? And three, and this is one thing I didn't hear, but I know he believes this too, how is it going to affect the people who now do the work? Because people are affected when you privatize. In point of fact, I have a record in this arena too, because in the city, in the mid-90s, we thought about privatizing trash collection. And the first year we put it out to bid, and we said, okay, employees, we want you to bid too. See what you can put on the table. And in point of fact, they came in with a bid that was better than the private sector. And so we awarded the bid to the employees through the city. And that worked very well. And then it got rebid again. And then it ended up in the private hands. But the point about this is that you don't just embrace it because of an ideological position. You embrace it in terms of effectiveness, and you always keep the employees in mind.
Thanks. Okay, our next question is, who is your political hero and why?
You know, I think Robert Kennedy is my political hero. You know, he was the senator in the state of New York when I was growing up, short period of time. And of course, he ran for president during the Vietnam War at a time when I was just coming of age. And here's a person who spoke out for the poor and for the powerless, and he knew how to get things done. And he knew how to work with people to do it. He was unafraid. He would have made a great president, and his words are still inspiring to me today.
Thanks. Mr. McChrystal?
I'm not sure that I can narrow it down to just one, but let me talk about a couple of them. I think in the Republican Party, you can't but help admire the courage of Abraham Lincoln. You can't but help admire the courage of Abraham Lincoln. He completely transformed this nation and, took a lot of our citizens and turned them into actual, honest-to-God, full human beings, not the 2-3/5 that were in the Constitution. Second is a Republican senator from Massachusetts, Robert Merrill, who created the land-grant college system. Virginia Tech is part of his legacy to America. Third would have to be Teddy Roosevelt, who created the National Park Service and is somebody who I think really, as David would say, left this world better than he found it. And then I think the fourth, and this may sound strange for a Republican, is John Kennedy. John Kennedy lifted this nation up with great goals. I remember as a little kid watching a man walk on the moon for the first time. Nobody thought that could happen, and he said, I'm committing this nation to achieving the goal. And his political vision made that work. One of my clients over the past couple of years, or a few years ago, was the Joseph P. Kennedy Jr. Foundation, and I got to work pretty closely with Eunice and Sergeant Shriver. I got to see how the legacy of the Kennedys of public service really is infused throughout that whole family, and I have to admire that whole family simply for that their commitment to public service. So those are the people who I look to for heroes.
Thanks, Mr. McChrystal. Ask you this next question first. Would you support statewide domestic partner benefits for lesbian and gay Virginians?
Depending on the details, probably yes.
That was under 2 minutes.
Yes, and I think it's instructive to try to think about what the General Assembly is doing right now and the concerns that I have about certain members of the Republican caucus and how they try to take away rights every time you turn the corner. There was a bill before the General Assembly last time that would have permitted private insurance companies to offer benefits voluntarily to whomever they wanted. And the social conservatives within the Republican Party stood up and tried to kill that bill because they didn't want to have benefits extended. That bill passed by one vote. And it was hard for me to understand how that could be true. So we have a lot of work to do. This is a progressive thinking community in the city of Charlottesville and Albemarle County. And there are bigger issues at the highest levels that are going to be decided on November 8th. Who's going to be the governor, lieutenant governor, and the attorney general? And you got to really think hard about who's going to move us forward and who's going to move us back. And I hope people will come out independent of who they vote for in this race and support Tim Kaine and the Democrats, because they're not going to move us in the direction that some of these social conservatives want us to go.
question. Low-income families pay a greater percentage of their income for state and local taxes than do middle-class and wealthy families. What would you do to change this and create a fairer tax system?
Great question. There were efforts made and some progress made 2 years ago as part of the budget compromise and the tax reform bill. I think Tom actually would have supported that. I think he said it in a forum. Of course, a number of people in the Republican caucus took a very strong position against that, including other legislators in this area. But one of the things that was done is because of this tax reform, it cut the taxes, I think, on 65% of the people who are paying taxes. And the way it was done, in part, was raising the floor before which people pay taxes so that the people at the lowest end got a break because they didn't even have to pay taxes until they made a certain amount of money. I think we should try to raise that floor a little bit more. I've always been a strong proponent of the earned income tax credit. The earned income tax credit is a way you can offset people's taxes that they would pay, and it tends to help low-income folks. Now, the problem with that is that if you don't pay taxes, you don't get much of a benefit. But there may be ways that we can work to extend that to give low-income folks more of a benefit. And I think we ought to raise the exemptions so that we give people more exemptions in filing their taxes.
Actually, I think before I go, since this has come up in David's last two responses, I want to point out that David's running against me and not the social conservatives in the General Assembly. I think one of the things that is actually important about that is I can be a bridge inside the Republican caucus from Charlottesville, from our community, to people who are making decisions. And some of those people are social conservatives on some issues, but they also have more moderate views on other issues. I talk to these people, and we work together when we can, and we don't work together. But I think that, you know, again, tax policy is something that's going to be really hard to talk about in 2 minutes. My view is that our entire tax system is broken. We have taxes that go back to the Spanish-American War. We have income taxes that are not necessarily indexed very well, so as inflation rises, your exemptions don't keep up. We have what in the business community is referred to as the hated B-poll tax, which taxes you even when a business isn't making money. Every business person I've talked to said, you know, I'm happy to pay an income tax, just don't, you know, if it's taxed on my profits, not on my gross. You know, that's the way that we do everything. I think that really what needs to happen is the entire tax system needs to be looked at. We need to completely restructure how we do it. We need to look at fewer taxes. We need to look at more streamlined taxes. And it's, you know, it's not something that you can get up, be a demagogue about, and make good policy. We really need to probably even have a special commission about reforming Virginia taxes, making them easier to pay, easier to file, and more fair all the way around.
Thanks, Mr. McChrystal. I want to remind the audience, if you have questions, Mr. Zakos is happy to take them and put them on cards. Mr. McChrystal, we'll start with you. What are each of your positions on UVA's charter decentralization and the two-tier workforce that will surely be part of it?
When I began this campaign, I actually sat down, as I said, with UVA's staff union to really try to understand how the charter was going to impact the workers at UVA. I also sat down and talked with some of the people who work for John Castine to talk about, you know, how this is going to impact their operations. I've also had a number of conversations with people inside the caucus about where this is all going. And I'll tell you one thing, is this is something that you can't really give answers to until the agreements are worked out. And from my conversations with other legislators, they're very concerned about how this is all going to work out, what the impact on workers are going to be, what the impact is going to be on costs to the state. And I've suggested, and it seems to me that I think that this is possible, is that rather than having oversight of the charter and management agreements be in JLARC, which is the Joint Legislative Oversight Committee, essentially, actually creating a special joint commission with a lifespan of 3 or 4 years to actually focus like a laser beam on making sure that not only do the management agreements work, but that everything works the way it's supposed to, and look at modifications to the agreement if it's not working. It's a critically important issue for our community, and I think that we need to have some real eyes on it. So that's an idea that I've actually floated, to actually have a special joint commission, and I think that it's easy to make that happen.
Thank you. A couple of points. First, the health of this community is linked inextricably to the health of the University of Virginia. So we need to figure out a way that the university can continue to be one of the top-notch places in the country to get an education or go to graduate school. The other thing is that the charter initiative, or what's now become higher ed restructuring, is really a function of the state's inability to commit to provide the funds to its flagship institutions around the Commonwealth. And even in the last legislative session, you know, the House Republicans, there they go again, right, weren't willing to vote for a budget bill that would have given UVA another $200 million. You know, I'm running against you, Tom, but these are the people within the legislature that are preventing critical funds from coming down to fund the things that are really important to people in this Commonwealth. I have concerns about the employees and how the employees are going to be treated within the context of these agreements. The devil's are always in the details. We haven't seen the details of the proposal, so it's hard to comment on them. But I'm going to continue to monitor those details and going to advocate for folks when I think it's appropriate. You know, I think that's going to be part of being a good legislator, and I need a lot of help from you to tell me what your concerns are in that arena. So thank you.
Thank you. Given recent reports, as late as April of 2005, that nuclear power plants have been targeted for possible terrorist attacks, how do you feel about Dominion Power's plans to build new reactors and extend the lifespan of their Lake Anna nuclear facility?
I have serious concerns about that. You know, I have a history of being opposed to the proliferation of nuclear power plants. I have real concerns about how you store the radioactive waste. I have real concern. You know, I don't have so much concern about the safety, although I think that issue is still a live one. But in terms of our long-term energy needs, we ought to be focused on how you conserve energy and how you figure out ways that you build buildings that conserve energy, rather than building new expensive power plants that really are not supportable in terms of the private sector. I mean, if you look at a lot of these places, they require huge insurance subsidies to be able to continue to operate. If you had to get private investors to have to support building them, they probably couldn't be built.
Well, I think that there are really two questions there. The first is the safety issue. And, you know, I think what we saw in Katrina recently was that the federal response and the state response and the local response really didn't work very well. I mean, there's an awful lot of finger-pointing that's going along. But, you know, in my business, we have this saying, only make new mistakes. And I think that when it comes to disaster planning, there's an awful lot of finger-pointing and very little sitting down and saying, wow, what went wrong and how do we fix it? I think that we really need to look at this issue, and we really need to, you know, have it be an important part of our disaster our disaster response plan. And that means getting the state, the feds, and local governments all together, all on the same page, so they all know what to do in case the unthinkable happens. On the energy issue, again, this is another, how do you answer it in 2 minutes? But, I think that we're in a situation right now where we can't shut down North Anna because we don't have better alternatives. I think that in the long term, we need to be putting a lot more money into alternative energy research. I think that we really need to deal with issues of getting away from fossil fuels, from fuels that actually cause greenhouse gases that may be causing global warming. We really need to move forward. We need to be looking at solar. We need to be looking at biodiesel. We need to be looking at some really innovative things. I actually just read an article about at MIT. They're actually taking the carbon dioxide out of their power plant, sending it through some reactors with algae that make oil, and then feeding the algae's oil that they created from the carbon dioxide back into the power plant. That's what a beautiful, interesting, unique way of doing it. Energy policy is tough, and I think that there's sometimes way too much politics and not enough technology. And it's one of the issues that I really am very concerned about and very engaged in.
Thank you. Would you sponsor a bill to overturn HB 751? Why or why not?
I've had this talk with a couple of people in the room, and my response is simply this: is I think that I don't think it's feasible given the what's happening in the General Assembly to do it. I don't plan to go to Richmond to sponsor bills that I know are going to go down to defeat. But what I do know is that there are elements of that that need to change. They need to change, and I think that, I would consider introducing legislation to make some changes that I think not only need to be made, but I think can actually get through the General Assembly. It's sometimes, politics is about the art of the possible, and, I think completely overturning it is impossible. I think making it less egregious is absolutely possible. So that's where I come down on that.
It prohibits gay marriage and civil unions. It declares it's the law of the state. And I would have voted against that bill if I'd been in the assembly when it got passed. The question is asked: would you introduce legislation to repeal it? I think I've answered this question 3 times during the primary, so I better make sure I get it right. I said no. Then I continue to say no. I don't think that bill is going to be repealed, and I just. It doesn't make sense for me to introduce legislation that's not going to work. I think that law is unconstitutional. I think that law could be struck down. It prohibits people from contracting, and I think that the U.S. Constitution ensconces that right in the Constitution, and I think that bill is probably unconstitutional. I think the bigger issue, really, and one that Tom didn't address, is what are we going to do with the constitutional amendment? And what are you going to do when you're asked to vote on whether you're going to put that on the ballot in the fall? He didn't answer that. I'm going to vote against putting that on the ballot in the fall. I think that's going to pass, too. That's going to be on the ballot in the fall. But I don't think that it's appropriate to place in the Virginia Constitution something that would be so discriminatory against one segment of the public. So that's why I'm going to vote against putting it on the ballot next fall. I don't think it's going to pass. I don't. Chuck, do you want to?
I'll answer that. On the constitutional amendment question, I've already told Delegate Cosgrove that I have grave concerns about putting something like that in the Constitution, and that I'm inclined to vote against it. He's not very happy with me, but he also understands my reasons, and we're going to work on other things together. But. Not only have I made my declaration here, I've also made it to members of the caucus.
Anything further?
No.
Okay. Next question. Do you support legislation calling for data collection by law enforcement officials on all routine traffic stops in order to document and curtail the incidence of racial profiling?
Good question. I'm opposed to racial profiling. I guess the question is what the bill would look like and the details in the bill itself. I mean, to collect data on every single traffic stop could be a very costly expense, especially for local governments. And you got to remember, I'm a local government guy. I spent 12 years in local government, and one of the things I never really liked very much is the way the federal government and the state government impose mandates on localities without giving them the money to fund them. So I think you really have to balance these two competing issues. You might want to start by having state troopers do it, and at least that would be a state funding mechanism, and it wouldn't impose the mandate on the localities without the money to pay for it. Now, you got to remember also, the state has promised money to localities. It was called HB 599 funding, which was for police protection that arose out of negotiations about all sorts of things in the General Assembly in the past. I think in only two out of the last 10 years have the state ever met its commitment to fully fund HB 599 with money coming back to the localities. So you got to be really careful before you accept the pledge from the state that they're going to give you money to fund that mandate.
I think the answer here is I'm the guy with the mustache. I think David and I actually agree on a lot of this, and it really depends on what the bill actually looks like. But I want to give you my perspective on this. Many years ago, I worked at a print shop down on the corner, and one of the really cool things that I got to do was design and print a poster for a concert by Wynton Marsalis, one of the greatest jazz people in the world. And went to the show. It was actually two shows. It was an amazing show. And as Wynton Marsalis, jazz great, world-renowned, was leaving Charlottesville, he got pulled over. And he got pulled over for the crime that, you know, is popularly known as driving while black. I can't tell you how much that incensed me then and how much it incenses me now. It's a problem that we need to nip in the bud. We need to stop it. And if there are things that we can do in terms of analyzing data, then we should do that. On the other hand, having dealt with privacy issues at the state level, I also know that, you know, collecting a huge database of people who get pulled over, sometimes for, you know, no legitimate reason, there's a real slippery slope there, and I'm very uncomfortable with having all of that data sloshing around in the state database. But I'm certainly willing to consider it, and I think that there are other measures that we can also take to take care of the issue of racial profiling. It just needs to stop.
Thank you. Based on the recent Supreme Court decision on eminent domain, what changes in Virginia law would you support?
The first bill that's going to be introduced in the legislature this year is going to be on eminent domain. There was a bill introduced by Delegate Marshall to limit eminent domain very, very, very strictly, and it was in response to the Kelo case, which was recently decided. In the General Assembly, people were like, no, we don't need this. The Supreme Court's going to do the right thing. And lo and behold, the Supreme Court did the wrong thing. I stood in the front row when the Republican caucus said, we're going to reintroduce this bill. It's going to pass very quickly. We're going to make it happen. So I support reforming of eminent domain. You know, in what happened in the Kelo decision, you know, it's basically theft. You're taken from regular people and giving it to a big corporation, and that's just wrong. And we need to do what it takes to get that fixed.
Can you imagine if Walmart went to the city council and said, well, you know, we need to build a super Walmart in Charlottesville. It's going to create a lot of jobs and create a lot of tax revenue, and we're going to put it on Joe's house on the bypass. How would you respond? I think most people would say no. You know, I believe that we wouldn't do that either. I didn't support the Kelo decision. The day after it was out, we issued a statement saying we didn't support it. We felt that Virginia law needed to be changed. We still believe that Virginia law needs to be changed. That was a decision that was unique to Connecticut, so we need to make sure the statute is right in Virginia. So if anybody challenges it, it'll be upheld. So I'm convinced that we're going to have a good law that comes out of Virginia that basically reserves eminent domain just for public use. Now, the other thing I might say is, again, I have a record. 12 years on the city council, I don't think once we ever condemned property. That's not a bad record.
Thanks. We're going to do two more questions and then have closing statements, gentlemen. If elected, would you put forth legislation to get state workers in Charlottesville a pay differential like they have in Northern Virginia, since housing and the overall cost of living is so high here?
That's a really good question, and it's really worth exploring in greater detail. You know, this is not the first time I heard this question, but I can tell you, once I did hear it, I started making some calls to find out about this. And my understanding is that there's been a lot of interest within the university in trying to think about the possibility of getting this pay differential. It's very complicated, and I think it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of compromise with the General Assembly to get it done. But I'm certainly with I certainly would be more than willing to take a close look at it and see what I could do.
I think that one of the responsibilities of a legislator is to represent your district first. And I think that this is an idea that really needs to be looked at. I think that it's an idea that will probably take two, maybe three sessions to get through. But fundamentally, you need to have someone in the room working through the business compromises when you're creating a budget. One of the advantages that I will have is I'll be part of the majority party, part of the majority caucus, I'll be in the room and I'll be able to effectively advocate for Charlottesville, for the people who work for the university, for state workers here. If you live in my district, you know, you're my first priority. And I think it's an idea that's definitely worth exploring. And, I'm going to actually take a look at actually introducing something like that, at least studying it.
Thank you. And for our final question of the evening, would you work hard to make sure Virginia is prepared for any kind of disaster, including terrorism or a natural disaster? And how would you make sure that your constituents know what the plan of action is in the case of a disaster?
That's a great question. And it's actually something that I've thought a lot about, not just because of the recent hurricanes, but in my business, we actually have a disaster recovery plan. It's something that you do. You look at what are all of the things that can possibly go wrong and what are your responses. So in my case, it's making sure that we have adequate backups. It's knowing, having a list of phone numbers where if we have to replace all of our equipment, how do we preserve our business going from a bad thing happens to we're back in business. And I think that the state can't do it alone. We need to have better coordination between the feds and the local government so that we don't have what happened in Louisiana, where the feds couldn't send the National Guard in because the governor didn't ask for it. That should be part of a checklist. I think it's critically important that we exercise those plans, that we actually work through mock drills from a statewide level on down. And I think that it's also really critically important to make sure that we have the communication facilities in place, and we've tested it, so that every level of government can talk to each other. Part of the problem in what happened in 9/11, part of the problem that happened with hurricanes, is that people had radios that couldn't talk to each other. You know, people were depending upon cell phones, which didn't work when the cell phone towers got blown down. Really, it's all about having a good plan in place and making sure that you exercise that plan on a regular basis to make sure that it actually works.
I actually actually have some governmental experience in doing this. I was on the city council when 9/11 happened, and within a week, we convened the health department, the fire department, police department, and all the other folks who deliver emergency services in our community, and said, we got them together and we said, look, we got to start doing some stuff differently here. The whole world has changed. And those people met on an ongoing basis for weeks and weeks and weeks, developing different approaches. Part of the approach that came out was going after a federal grant that would help improve the radio communication system for the University of the City and the County, and that's now in place. And that's because people proactively took action early on, put together the package, and got it done. And I think we got to think more at the state level on how we do that. There's a looming crisis here that you don't think about in terms of a hurricane, but it's nonetheless a crisis, especially for people who don't have much money. And that's the impending fuel crisis. And I don't know that many people around here really thought very clearly about what's going to happen. Well, the city of Charlottesville puts money in its budget every year for fuel assistance. I voted for those things. But it's not enough money. What are we going to do? The city of Charlottesville owns the gas division. Part of what I'm sure they're going to do is they're going to take some of what they would otherwise receive in quote profit and plow it into lower gas rates so that people in their homes are not forced out. What are we going to do for people who need shelter? You know, I view a legislator a little bit differently than some people do. My role is not just to make laws. My role is to get out there and try to lead the community. And so the day after this election, I'm going to be out there trying to convene people to deal with what I think could be a real problem here this winter. And I think it's going to take a multi-jurisdictional approach to get it solved.
Thank you. Mr. Toscano, I'm going to have you do your closing statement.
Thank you very much, and thanks again for the opportunity to come and you sponsoring and all you coming out here to listen to us. I hope that in considering who you're going to vote for on November 8th, you'll take a look at our experiences, and you'll take a look at our websites and our publications and whatever you got out there that you can compare us on the issues. And I hope that you'll conclude after that I have the experience and skills necessary to do a good job for you in Richmond. It is pretty easy to judge, you know, what I've done and how I've done it, because I have been around here for a while, and I have tried to involve a lot of people who are in this room tonight in the basic decisions that affect your lives in the community. In this community. You know, in the mid-1990s, the city of Charlottesville was faced with a critical fiscal problem. We were in a position where we could not service our needs and still balance our budget. And so what I did as mayor is I brought many people into City Hall from the county, the city, and university, and said, well, here are the options. Here are our choices. What do you think we should do? And on the basis of those meetings, we as a city council forged a consensus on what the city should do. And we started doing things differently. And we started expanding the tax base. And as a result, Charlottesville is a much stronger place than it was 10 years ago. And this region is a much better place than it was 10 years ago. What you'll get from me is pure and simple. You'll get somebody who knows how to listen, to potentially change their mind on issues. You'll get somebody who's prepared, who's knowledgeable. You'll get somebody who can advocate for you and advocate for those who don't have a voice. And I hope that when you consider all those factors, you'll support me on November 8th, and you'll also support the Democratic ticket on November 8th. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Toscano. Mr. McChrystal?
This election is important, and it's important for actually a reason that David just brought up. I believe everybody needs a voice. And as I've been in Richmond working with the legislature to create good laws, One of the things that I noticed is that Charlottesville really doesn't have a voice. That Charlottesville has not made itself, Charlottesville City Council have not been very friendly to the General Assembly. I had the great honor and privilege to work with Mitch Vanieres to try to push one of his bills through. And, you know, it's been tough for Mitch for the last couple of years because he's from Charlottesville and people get shut down. Decisions are being made, whether you like it or not, you know, inside the Republican caucus. And really, if you want Charlottesville to have a voice, you need a guy in the room. You know, it's plain and simple that. I'm going to be in the room. You know, and I got to tell you this. You know, if I don't deliver, if I don't go to the General Assembly and, you know, and give Charlottesville a voice back, throw me out in 2 years. That's how the system is supposed to work. You know, I recognize that when I go there, I'm going to actually have to get some things done, and I know that I can get things done. David talks about the critical fiscal crisis. 2 years ago, when the state was trying to get its budget through, I was there. I sat through the meetings. I sat through the hearings where we had people from New York saying what would happen if Virginia lost its AAA bond rating. I was in legislators' offices as they were making decisions to actually about whether or not they were going to vote for a budget, what the compromises are going to be. I know how that process works. You know, and frankly, you know, David talks about it was the Democrats and, you know, these moderate Republicans. Those moderate Republicans that he's talking about are friends of mine. You know, I know how hard it was for them to make a decision. You know, it pretty much comes down to this. When you vote on Election Day, you just have to make a choice who is going to be the most effective legislator. I think David's a good guy. I think he's got great ideas sometimes. But I think that I'm going to be able to go put my experience to work that's very focused on the state level and really take care of this district. So on Election Day, I hope you vote. And I hope that that when you cast your ballot for your delegate for the House of 57th, or for the House of Delegates in the 57th, it'll be for Tom McChrystal. Thank you, and thank you all for coming out. This is democracy at work. So I want to give you guys a hand.
Thank you. Will you please join me in thanking Mr. Tom McChrystal and Mr. David Toscano? On behalf of the Quality Community Council, the Interfaith Gay Straight Alliance, the League of Women Voters, and the Virginia Organizing Project, just want to thank you all for coming out tonight and for being a part of our forum and remind you to vote on November the 8th. Thank you all again.
This has been the Charlottesville Broadcasting Network's presentation of the second debate of the 57th House District race between Republican Tom McChrystal and Democrat David Toscano. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Thanks for listening.